Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Wow, I'm no one's wife right now. I'm no one's mom. I'm no one's friend. I'm no one's daughter. I'm no one's anything. It's just me in the studio alone, and I get to think, and I get to explore, and I get to experiment. And so, yeah, I think for me, like, timing is always everything, and I finally had the space to really, I had some distance, I guess. I had some distance from all of those really intense early feelings of motherhood, so I could speak about it more objectively and more openly.
I am so honored to welcome Sandeep Johal to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Sandeep is a Canadian visual artist whose practice engages drawing, large-scale painting, and hand-stitched textiles. Her Indo-folk feminine aesthetic is characterized by her distinct pattern work, bold use of color, and ornamentation. Sandeep's work typically centers around the stories of women. Though she highlights female suffering caused by gender-based violence and femicide, these are ultimately stories of resistance and resilience. Her work also celebrates her South Asian heritage. Sandeep lives in Vancouver, Canada with her partner and her six-year-old son. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so thrilled to have you.
Thanks so much, Kaylin. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes, I can't wait for this conversation. Just really, really happy that we were able to make this work. So always like to have my artist start by pointing us back to something in your childhood that you feel like connects to your life as an artist today. Maybe just, you know, tell me, have you always wanted to be an artist, or like what was kind of the starting point there or something you point to as inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, I always did art as a kid, and my mom would buy me these lined pads of paper and I would just sit there and draw. I think line work is the sort of aesthetic thing that connects me from childhood to my art today, because line work is such a strong part of my practice. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if I consciously knew that I wanted to be an artist, because I grew up in a small town and I didn't really know that that was an option. Like, there was no one in my immediate South Asian community to look to, or even, you know, the larger community in general. So I didn't have any role models, and this was pre-internet, so I didn't have access either. but like, all I knew was that art made me feel really whole.
Mm. I love that. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Okanagan.
Okay. And what's that for somebody who doesn't know?
Yeah, it's just like 4 hours away from Vancouver.
Okay. I was like, it sounds like a Canadian word, but... I've never been to Western Canada, so I'm just not as familiar with like what's happening over there.
But, yeah.
That's awesome.
Pretty cool. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, like typical, you know, line, I love that connection to your line work, because that is distinctive, like just beyond standard. I had crayons around me all the time, but like making that recognition between the line work being something that you really loved doing and still connect to today, I think is really great. So speaking of your line work, can you describe your art for somebody maybe who has not yet had the pleasure to see it? You could talk a little bit about your materials that you use and your process.
Yeah, so I do a lot of drawing, collage work. Textiles are new to me, so I'm going to start exploring those a bit more. And then I do a lot of
textiles are new to you?
Yeah.
What? Your new show is like all textile based.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, it's all hand stitched. I didn't use a sewing machine because I'm a masochist.
Oh my God. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but wow, that just like blew my mind.
So I do drawing, collage, textiles, which are new to me, and then I do large scale mural painting. I consider myself a maximalist, so I love to cram as much as I can into a piece, but leave enough space for the viewer to rest their eyes. I do a lot of pattern-based work. I'm really inspired by the patterns from my heritage. You know, growing up, my mom had so many different textiles just lying around her house. And so, you know, I'm constantly looking at like borders of saris and all of these patterns on her suits. And it really, I didn't realize like how much I had soaked all of that up. And then, of course, you know, the really bold, bright, vibrant colors. But my favorite color palette is usually like black and white with variations on primary colors.
I love that. I'm usually not drawn to a lot of black and white work. Like it's just the, I'm just like such a colorist, like color fan, but I feel like the way you use it is so, it's like, it makes the colors more vibrant to me and my eye catches them in a stronger way maybe than if there wasn't that contrast. So I love that about your work.
Yeah, I love the contrast. And like with my murals, I do a lot of murals on black backgrounds, and then the figures and the animals are often black and white, and then everything else is like super bold and colorful. So it is a pretty stark contrast, which I just...
I love it. I feel like it just, I don't know, carries your eye around your work in such a fluid way. It's so nice. So you mentioned like being inspired by saris. Can you tell me a little bit about your South Asian heritage and like how you've, you know, kind of referenced that within your work a little bit more?
Yeah, so like I said before, I grew up in a really small town and the South Asian population was quite small as well. And so, you know, when you're from a different culture and you live in a place that's not very diverse, you kind of just want to conform. And so I found myself doing that, and I found myself being ashamed of my heritage. And I, you know, I thought it was really embarrassing. You know, if my mom was wearing an Indian suit out in public, I was like, oh my God, I hope no one sees me. And then, you know, as I grew up, became an adult, I realized, you know, just how much my culture has given me and how much it's my identity. And I just felt so ashamed. I just felt this deep shame about turning my back on my heritage. And so I think that's part of the reason why it's such a big part of my art practice, because I don't want to be ashamed anymore. And I want to show that pride. So I show it through the aesthetics of the work.
I love that. What do you think it was that kind of helped you unlock, I don't know, and let go of some of that shame? Like, do you feel like it was just like adolescence, like, you know, like just kind of the emotional toil of being like a young person? Yeah, just interested to hear a little bit more about that journey.
I think just kind of being away from my small town and moving to Vancouver and meeting people from different walks of life and different cultures and seeing how much pride people had in their own cultures, and then meeting more South Asian people who had similar mindsets as myself and, you know, seeing the pride that they have in their culture, in our culture. And so, yeah, I think it just came with becoming older and wiser.
But also with visibility, right? Like,
For sure. And I know representation is such a hot topic right now, but really it's so important, you know, having that representation, seeing yourself in, you know, in the media, seeing yourself in books, seeing yourself on TV, in films. It's so important, you know, like with my murals, I definitely make sure that when people look at them, they know that it's made by a South Asian hand. You know, it's, you know, partly because it's in public, it's in the public realm. Anyone has access to it, but I really want people from my community to stumble across the work and be like, oh, I feel a connection to this work. I feel like it represents who I am and where I come from. And I actually got a message from this woman who had recently moved from India. And she was like, I was walking through the alleyway and I was feeling really homesick. And then I saw your mural and I was like, wow, that really feels like home to me. Aww. And then I saw your, and I knew it was by a South Asian person and I felt so connected. And I just was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is what I want my work to be about.
Yeah. Money can't buy that feeling, right?
No,
oh, that's awesome. I love that. And I love that, I don't know, that's on your mind, you know, when you're making work, you're not just thinking about your own story and like expressing your truth, but you're also kind of thinking about how you sharing and leaning into your identity and your authentic self, like how that will provide visibility and, you know, like a space for other people to connect, you know, to their own story. I feel like that's a really powerful thing that art does, you know, mm-hmm. especially when we're intentional about it, like you're being.
For sure. And that's why I love the storytelling, especially when it comes to women, because, you know, growing up in a South Asian household, I very quickly realized that my brother was being treated quite differently than my sister and I. And when I would ask my parents, like, oh, why does he get to do that? And we don't get to do that. And why does he get to say that? But we can't say that. And it was just this kind of like, well, you know, he's a boy. And it would just like make my blood boil. And I would just keep at it. I would keep questioning my parents. I would keep hassling them, you know, wanting to know the reason behind it. And they would never give me a reason. It was always just because he's a boy. And so I think that's when the little activist in me started, you know, like, and then I would see how women were treated within my culture and then in the community at large. And it just, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand why women were subjected to things men weren't subjected to, and why people felt like they should have more agency over a woman's life and be able to control what a woman should feel or think or do or how a woman should present herself. And so I think that's where my interest in telling women's stories came from, you know, to give women a voice, especially women who no longer have a voice because they've died due to gender-based violence in its many forms and, you know, general femicide.
Tell me how you're engaging with those stories in your artwork. I know your work is generally very narrative. Maybe you could walk me through the process of like researching some of those stories, and then like what do you kind of do to get to the final piece? Like, do you sketch? Are you, you know, having conversation? Like, just tell me a little, like, unpack sort of your process for me and how it relates to this idea of, you know, sharing women's stories.
Sure. Yeah. So when I was in art school in the mid 2000s, I started seeing all of these headlines about honor killings in British Columbia, where I live, in the Lower Mainland. And I was so surprised because I thought, well, doesn't this happen somewhere else? Like, this happens where I live. And so I started cutting out, you know, this is like, again, I hadn't really started using the internet that much. So I'm like cutting out articles from the newspaper and I'm building this file folder of all of these stories. And then we had this assignment in our printmaking class to do three prints, and each print had to be connected to each other in some way. And so I decided to do a print series called When Honor Kills. And it was questioning that notion of honor that's so strong. Families are willing to kill their female relatives, not their male relatives, but their female relatives over it. And so the first one I dedicated to Jaswinder Sidhu, whose death was ordered by her parents. And the second one I did was Amandeep Atwal, whose dad actually stabbed her to death. And both of these women died because their parents didn't like their choices in partners because they were not Indian or they were lower caste. And then the third print just repeated the word Izzet, and Izzet means honor. And so I was questioning, you know, Izzet, what is it? And so I remember at the Crit, I was super nervous because this was such a personal work for me. And I was really afraid of like the reaction, or, you know, would I be showing my culture in a negative light? Would people get it? Would people even care? And my printmaking teacher, I always remember this, and I've carried this with me into all of my work since. He said that I took a really ugly topic and I presented it in such a beautiful way that it was palatable. And that was a really hard thing to do. And so that kind of made me realize that, you know, I don't want to hit anyone over the head with whatever I'm trying to, with whatever I'm trying to share, but I want to pull people into the work. And so I realized that if I make really aesthetically pleasing work, people will get pulled into it. But the longer they look at the work, they'll start seeing that there's something maybe a bit amiss, mm-hmm. or something a bit unsettling, and they'll be forced to recontextualize the work.
I love that. So smart and so powerful. And again, I feel like you have this deep understanding, or at least the same understanding that I have of like what the purpose of art is, right? Like, just it's supposed to bring connection. It's supposed to unearth stories and provide visibility and, I don't know, like showcase beauty and emotion and the human experience in a way that few other things can really do, I guess.
Yeah, and like how lucky are we as artists that we get that privilege and that honor to talk about these topics that may be difficult for people to talk about and, you know, put it out there in a visual way to help people understand it and maybe get them interested in doing something about it and then in some way affecting some kind of change. Mm-hmm. My first solo show was in 2017, and it was called Rest in Power, and it was dedicated to 12 women whose murders had really impacted me deeply. And I remember when I was initially talking about the show, I would say 12 women whose deaths had impacted me. And I was like, oh, but they didn't just die. They were murdered. Mm. And they were murdered because they were women. That was the only reason. And so understanding that distinction was so huge for me. And it ended up being 10 collage and line drawing goddesses, each representing a different woman in her story. And then I had 3 paintings that were inspired by Shaughnessy Baldwin's novel, The Selector of Souls. And when people were at the show, I should mention, underneath each of the drawings, I had a quote by a loved one talking about the woman, but it didn't say who the person was or what had happened. It was just a quote in honor of them. And so it was really cool to see people look at the piece and then they read the quote and then they would look at the piece again. And it just made them recontextualize the work. It made them think about, well, who is this person? What happened to them? And who is this person that they left behind that's been affected by their passing? It was really amazing. It was the best first show I could have ever had. Got a ton of press. People were really visibly moved by the work. And I just felt like, yes, this is the power of art. Like, this is what I'm here to do.
I love that too. And that you had this experience of really taking a big risk. Like, I feel like this is like a lot, you know, to put on the table for your first solo show. So I feel like it's just celebratory. Like, I'm celebrating with you to hear that, like, it was such a success in terms of it getting press and feeling like people were really engaging with it. That must have felt really good.
It felt great. And like, I love taboo, you know, I love uncomfortable conversations. I love discomfort. Like, I love all of that stuff. And I feel so comfortable talking about it that it just feels such a natural thing for me to do.
Well, speaking of taboo, let's come back to this conversation around motherhood, which I know your most recent show was about. Before we get to that conversation, I want you to walk me through. So I now know that your last solo or your first solo show was in 2017, which was 4 years ago. Could you kind of walk me through maybe like, I don't know, just sort of the steps towards building your art career? Are you a full-time artist? Do you have another job? What's kind of happened between that first solo show and then, you know, the most recent shows? It seems like you have a lot of traction in your art career right now. So kind of how has that built up over the past 4 years?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to when I had my son, because I had him in 2015. And at that time, I was working for a not-for-profit. But really like feeling the urge to start making art again, because I had kind of stopped after art school and my husband was encouraging me to get back into it. So slowly I was, but I wasn't really serious about it. And then I had my son and something just switched in me. And my husband was like, well, why don't you stay at home with him? I'd feel much better knowing that you were with him. And then why don't you work on your art career seriously? And I was like, what? Are you serious? Like, really? And he's like, yeah, but you have to be serious about it. And so finally I was, you know, given the opportunity to actually do the thing that I've been wanting to do my entire life. And at this point I was 40 years old and I was like, okay, let's do this thing. But I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anyone in the art community. I was pretty isolated. And then I met Jamie Smith from Thrive Art Studio, and she brought me into the fold. She was just starting Thrive at that time. So I came in at the ground up, and I was a member of Thrive for 3 years. And it was so instrumental in my career. It helped me build community. I learned so much about, you know, my art practice. I also learned so much about the business side of art. You know, I never really thought about art being a business, but it is. You know, as an artist, you are running a small business and you have to know how to do that. And I also met my art consultant, Penny Lane Chen, when I joined Thrive as well. And so she's been with me for the past 5 years, guiding and mentoring me, which has been just incredible. And then in 2017, I did my first mural, my first outdoor mural with Van Mural Fest. And then that opened me up to a whole new community of artists and support. And so it was kind of like Thrive and Van Mural Fest both came in at the right time and really supported me in my practice. And then all of these opportunities just started coming.
That's amazing. I love hearing that. Tell me more about your mural work. Like, was that something that you, I don't know, kind of thought you wanted to do? Or like, how did you get into that? I feel like for me, murals are really intimidating. So I'm just wondering, like, kind of if that was something you always knew you wanted to do, or did you have to, you know, go through a process of really learning what that's about? Because now it seems like you do murals all the time. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. I think, like, I painted a mural of, like, aliens playing pool back in the 90s. I wish I had a photo of it. It's probably so weird looking. But I love street art. Like, I just love the way murals can completely transform public space. And oftentimes in the most unusual spaces. And so my husband and I went to Buenos Aires for a honeymoon in 2012. And that was my first time actually seeing buildings wrapped in murals. And it was just so exciting turning this, you know, turning a corner and seeing a gigantic mural, walking down an alleyway and then seeing tons of murals. Just changes the way you look at a place, and it helps you understand more about the place that you're in. And so we went on a tour, and the tour guides talked about sort of the social and political concepts behind the murals. And then that really clicked with me, because I was like, oh, they're not just pretty. They're talking about something, and they're talking about things that are affecting these artists who live in this country. And how incredible is that? And so I think that really piqued my interest. But I, you know, I didn't do anything about it until actually Thrive Art Studio. I did my first indoor mural through their mural residency program. So they have, or they had, I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but a mural residency program for female artists to kind of help us understand how to paint a mural in a very low risk, safe environment and build confidence. And so I did that mural before I did my Van Mural Fest mural, and that really helped with my confidence.
Awesome. I love that. And tell me a little bit more about your mural practice now. Like, how often do you do murals? I don't know, just like for somebody maybe who wants to get interested in them, how do you price a mural? Like, how do you, you know, get hired for a commission? And like that alone feels very intimidating. I'm like, I have no idea what it's like a good standard for a mural. Talking about that, like kind of the business side of it.
Yeah, it's I don't think I had the intention, or I didn't know that I would become a mural artist. But when I did the one with Van Mural Fest, again, I got a lot of press. I did a mural of a folk art, sort of in a folk art style, where it was a black and white woman standing on a black and white tiger. And then the rest was like really bold, vibrant, bright colors. It was very like graphic art kind of. And I think it was just really different from what people normally think a mural is. And it really grabbed the attention of the South Asian community as well. And so they were super pumped to, you know, see this piece of work that really represented our community. And then, you know, I just realized how much I love the challenge of painting on a wall in public and the interactions that I can have with people who are passing by. You know, each mural is always so different based on location, based on the size of the wall, based on the texture of the wall. I've done corporate murals. I've done murals for mural fests. I've worked with not-for-profits, and I really love when I can paint the work that I want to paint. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when it's the mural that I want to paint, it's got a figure of a woman. I always want figures of women in my work in public space. Mm-hmm. And it's just like super bright and vibrant. And when I was painting a mural for this festival, Art Smash, here in Vancouver through Van Mural Fest, I was painting it at the height of the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. And it's got a really bold figure of a woman, black and white, front and center. It was my first time painting a black background, and then I had all of these colorful plants and birds. And I always have snakes in my work because I love the way they look. Mm-hmm. And I thought the piece was initially about, you know, raising your voice and speaking out against injustice, especially when it comes to women, especially when it comes to assault. But then I realized it was actually about taking up space, you know, physical space, because as women, we're always taught to shrink. We're taught not to take up physical space. We're taught to sit with our legs together, you know, and I was like, I don't want to subscribe to that. You know, I want to encourage women to just take up space. And like, what better way to take up space than by painting gigantic women on public walls, literally taking up space.
I love that. And I love how this really connects to, you know, some of the same, like, I feel like a lot of what you're saying connects to just this idea of an artist and a female artist in particular needing to take up space and taking ownership of their art. I've been having some conversations with women that I'm kind of in a mentorship role with, just about like how they feel so adverse to self-promotion and how they feel like every time they like promote their work or, you know, promote that they have work for sale or just like, it's like they feel so icky, like they can't talk about their work. And I'm just like, oh my God, the layers of this. I mean, it just goes so deep, you know, like just these things that we're told that we shouldn't be doing and how we feel it in our bones that we shouldn't be taking up space on Instagram, on people's walls, on podcasts, like wherever it is. It's just so deep and it makes me so angry.
Oh, I'm like right there with you. And, you know, like when I started my Instagram account, I kind of felt like a smarmy businessman, you know, and I was like, ugh, like I felt that same ick factor. But then I was like, you know what? I need to approach my career like a man. Yeah. And I need to like ask for what I want. And, you know, I've gotten much more confident and much better at asking for what I want. And it's amazing when you do it, people are like, yeah, okay.
Tell me some more examples of that. Have you sold work on Instagram? Like, tell me how Instagram has influenced your career and what is your approach to it?
I think like most people, I have a real love-hate for Instagram. Mm-hmm. I get really, like, I always think of that quote, comparison is the thief of joy. Mm-hmm. And I find I can get kind of wrapped up in like, oh, I want my career to be there. Or, oh, I wish my artwork looked like this. Mm-hmm. You know, and just like falling down the old shame spiral. But then, you know, I've just found so many incredible artists through Instagram and, you know, I've met really wonderful people and collaborators. And so I'm trying to look at it more as a tool for engagement and a tool for connection. Mm-hmm. I've been like obsessively promoting my show. So I've been on Instagram like way too much, but, you know, I don't actually make a lot of like physical work to sell. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always marveling at how when people do art releases, you know, I always pay attention to like people making big bodies of work, and then they build up the excitement, and then they release the body of work, and then it sells out in like a day or like 5 minutes. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. So I'd like to make more work for people to actually purchase, more work that's accessible. I do a drawing study sale like once a year. I'm actually going to do one though coming up where I just release like 20 drawing studies for under $100, and they go like pretty fast, which is nice. And it helps build up clientele, because like part of my mandate for my art practice is that I always want to make sure I have work that's accessible. So if someone wants to purchase something of mine, they can purchase something for under $100, you know, and just to encourage people to like build their art collections. And if you can buy something for under $100, you're more likely to start building an art collection. You know, I make the bulk of my, I would say the bulk of my income comes through murals.
Yeah, I love that. And I, that's exactly what we've been talking about with this particular group, where we were kind of talking about like self-promotion and feeling ashamed and stuff. You know, just because then it kind of spiraled into this conversation about, well, I don't want to be seen as like greedy, or like, I don't want my art to get to this place where people can't afford it. And, you know, I feel the same as you. Like, I always want my art to be accessible to people in my community and people in my peers, you know, and like, I'm not just looking to sell to people who make a ton of money. Like, of course I would love clients who can afford, you know, a several thousand dollar painting or a $10,000 painting one day from me. But, you know, I also always want to have like lower price point items, because I just believe in the power of collecting art, you know, and I think that helped reframe it a little bit too. Like, maybe just having, you know, variety within your work, and just not feeling like you're just climbing this ladder. Like, it you can have multiple legs and different outlets that serve different purposes and serve different people, you know?
Yeah. And you get to choose. You're the artist, right? Like, this is your career. This is your work. I just listened to a really good podcast episode on Extra Paint, and they were interviewing Lisa Congdon. They were talking about that. She was like, I sell stuff for a dollar. I sell paintings for 20 grand. She's like, who cares? She's like, sell what you want, sell to whoever you want. Do it the way you want. Don't worry about the art world. And so I think it's, you know, the whole idea of the art world is becoming this sort of outmoded thing, because people now can just sell directly to their client. And so it's an interesting time, because we're finding ways to move out of that old structure and kind of define how we want to run things. And so part of what I like about my practice is that it is really varied. Like, I paint murals, but then I also do shows in public institutions. You know, I painted 4 murals inside the Vancouver Art Gallery, which was like such an amazing project. You know, I do a lot of talks, I do a lot of illustration. So I do a lot of different things. And I think that's what keeps me really engaged in my practice, because I'm not trying to do this one thing and work with this one type of organization with this one type of client.
I love that. And I love, maybe the art world is just the shit we make up in our heads.
Yeah, totally.
Maybe there is no art world.
Like, it's that idea of like, there's these gatekeepers, and we need to like, you know, get access to those gatekeepers, so then we can be legitimized. And I mean, there is a sense of legitimacy, you know, when you've done a project with the Vancouver Art Gallery, you know, like that was a big deal. I was like, whoa, I'm like 3 years into, or 2 years into my career, and I just did a project with them, and this is amazing. And it did feel good, and I felt legitimized. But, you know, I also do murals, which, you know, people considered really lowbrow, and now they're becoming more highbrow, and organizations and corporations and institutions all want murals. And so it's just kind of like figuring out what works for you and what aligns with your values. And I think that's the big one. Like, does it align with your values?
I love that. And I just love too that, back to that point of how, you know, we're really trying to dismantle this old way of doing things by forging our own path, you know, but I feel like one of the beautiful things about women artists right now is that we're doing it together. You know, like we're not just doing it by ourselves, like the Joan Mitchells and the, you know, like those in the past who really had to be cutthroat. You know, we're really trying to like link arms and do this like with each other, which I feel like is so special.
Yeah, totally.
I'm delighted to share that this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast is sponsored by an artist, mother, and tax expert, Hannah Cole of Sunlight Tax. Is your creative practice gaining steam? Maybe you just got a big grant or a big show. You're excited to get to work, but a nagging feeling tells you that there are some tax issues that could hurt you. What you don't know might actually be holding you back from all that you can accomplish. You just want to get down to the studio and do the work you love, but finances and tax concerns are dragging you down. Thankfully, Sunlight Tax is here for you. Artist and tax pro Hannah Cole started Sunlight Tax to empower creative people with the tax and money tools you need so you can have more money, more time, and make a bigger impact with your work. Who doesn't want that? Sunlight Tax offers an annual membership called Money Bootcamp, which is tailored to your busy creative life to teach you targeted skills for your financial health and taxes. Hannah guides you through the pitfalls into simple systems so you can stay on track, start investing in yourself, and get back to the studio without getting bogged down. Right now, listeners of the Artist Mother Podcast can get a free artist tax deduction guide by going to sunlighttax.com/artistmother. That's sunlighttax.com/artistmother. Thank you, Hannah, for providing so much to artists and helping us through with all of our financial concerns. It's so reassuring to have experts like you we can trust and we know are looking out for us. Head to sunlighttax.com to find out more about everything Hannah has to offer, and don't forget your free artist tax deduction guide just for our community at sunlighttax.com/artistmother. Okay, Sandeep, tell me a little bit about your motherhood journey. I know you have one kiddo. You said he's 6, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to hear a little bit about just how your journey as a mother sort of has influenced your role as an artist, and maybe walk me through some of the ways, you know, you kind of already talked about the beginning where you sort of used this opportunity staying home with your kid to investigate your art career and start to build it up slowly. But you know, I'm curious too, just about like thematically how motherhood has sort of weaved its way into your art, and because now you are actually making art about motherhood. Your most recent show was about it. And then, you know, too, maybe you could start with just structurally, like how are you day to day raising a kid and, you know, making an art career for yourself, and like, how have you been doing those two things in tandem? That was my experience too, was I already actually had a kid before I went back for my MFA and really have started to build my career. So motherhood was like there at the beginning for me, you know?
Yeah. I think for me, like I often heard mothers talk about how when they became mothers, they lost themselves and they lost their identity. And for me, my identity has always been very important to me. And so I was like, well, I don't want to lose my identity. Like, I don't want my child to become my whole life. I want my child to enhance my life. Mm-hmm. And so doing art for a living now has made me so much more fulfilled. And I feel like because I'm so much more fulfilled, I can be a better mother because I have something else other than my son. You know, of course I love him and I'm so happy that I have him, but I need more than that. I need the art. And so he gets to see me as his mother, but then he also gets to see me as this other person, this artist whose life that he's also very involved in. And, you know, he gets to see that identity that's separate from mother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hopefully that will also encourage him to think outside the box and, you know, dream bigger.
Yes.
Because for me, it was like, well, how do I tell my child to dream big if I'm too scared to pursue the thing that I want to do? Mm-hmm. You know, so that was part of the push to like really work through all the fear and, you know, the fear of failure, the fear of vulnerability, all of that, to just push through it and just do the thing. And so we don't have any family in our, in Vancouver. So we had to kind of do everything on our own. Childcare is super expensive here. Mm-hmm. And also I was like, well, I don't really want to leave him with someone else because these are his formative years. And like, I want to be the one there, even though it's hard. And even though I'm exhausted, I still want to be that person who's there. And so I just made him part of my art life. Like mm-hmm. I just carried him everywhere. I don't drive. So we took the SkyTrain, the bus, wherever we had to go, taxis, like whatever. I took him with me to meetings. I took him with me to all my vendors. And so, you know, 6 years later, he knows my framer really well. He knows all the deluxe paints really well, you know, the people at the art store. And so he's just a part of it. Like I took him on studio visits. I've taken him to so many galleries throughout the years, art events, and it's just kind of second nature to him now. So mm-hmm. it's not like a big deal for him to like go to a gallery or like go to an art event. But having said that, he does have the personality for it. So he's very extroverted. He loves being around people. And so he really enjoys the adventure of going to new places and meeting new people. Mm-hmm. So that was actually easy. And, you know, like I did struggle with motherhood. I knew it was going to be hard, but I mean, you can know something and then know something. Yeah. And so I just felt really confused because I had all of these sort of contradictory feelings emerge. And I'm like, aren't I supposed to be like super happy? I just birthed mm-hmm. this human that I wanted to birth, but I'm feeling angry and I'm feeling resentful and I'm feeling intensely like lonely and sad. Mm-hmm. And I'm just crying all the time. And like, why? I don't understand this. And then, you know, you try to talk to people about it, even other mothers, and I know people try to be well-meaning, but, you know, when you kind of shell out these empty platitudes like, oh, you're doing great, mama, you got this, mm-hmm. this too, it just meant like made me feel worse. It made me feel more lonely and more incompetent. And so, you know, I really struggled. I really had to work hard, had to look inside and really ask myself some hard questions and like, where are these behaviors coming from? Why am I acting like this? What from my childhood is triggering this? What kinds of things did my parents do? How did my parents react to my big feelings? All of those things. And then I knew I wanted to do a show around motherhood, but I wanted to really talk about the dark side of motherhood, keeping in line with like the uncomfortable things I like to talk about. And so when Bard Arts Foundation offered me a 10-week residency, I thought, yes, this is time to finally explore this because my son will be in kindergarten. I'll have the time and the space. I had a studio for the residency that was mine. And so I went there every day and it was just like, wow, I'm no one's wife right now. I'm no one's mom. I'm no one's friend. I'm no one's daughter. I'm no one's anything. It's just me in the studio alone. And I get to think and I get to explore and I get to experiment. And so, yeah, I think for me, like timing is always everything. And I finally had the space I had some distance, I guess. I had some distance from all of those really intense early feelings of motherhood. So I could speak about it more objectively and more openly.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, because I think it can be a lot to balance sort of being in the thick of it and really trying to process it at the same time and make art about it. Like it takes so much deep headspace. And I love this idea of like kind of finding either time or space or, you know, just a little bit of distance to give yourself the space to like process and then like really lean into the work in a new way or let the work be influenced by that thing that you went through, you know? And so tell me about the work. You made this solo show called Beast of Burden, right?
Yeah.
You made this show in 10 weeks, like from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. So tell me all about this work. You have three main walls in the show, right?
Yeah. I think I had an idea of what I was going to do when I went into the residency. I had a consult with Penny Lane and we kind of came up with this idea, but then I don't know, it just kind of, it didn't seem as like dramatic as I wanted it to be. And so I spent a day writing down like all of my dark feelings, you know, around motherhood, all of those kind of impermissible feelings. And then I started noticing they were kind of fitting into categories. And so I developed these three categories. One was anger, you know, the mom rage. One was sort of a coupling of sadness and loneliness. And then the third one really took me by surprise. And I think that's the one I feel like most shame about. It was emotional immaturity. And I realized that I think I have a pretty good EQ when it comes to life. But as a mother, I realized my EQ was not that great. And I felt really emotionally immature. And I was like, well, why can't I cope with these things? Why are these things so hard for me to cope with? Am I his mother or am I his sibling? Like, who am I? And yeah, I just felt like really ashamed of that because, you know, I thought like, I'm the one that's supposed to be the mother, the parent, the one that knows the answers, the one that's carrying my child. But sometimes I found that he was the one teaching me and he was the one carrying me when I didn't have the capacity to be a mother, you know, in that moment. And so then I put these post-its up on the wall in the studio and then immediately I was like, oh my God, if someone sees these, they're going to think that I'm a bad mother and they're going to judge me and I should just take these off the wall. But then I was like, well, isn't that what this show's about? Talking about those ideas around judgment, people thinking that you're a bad mother, those, the trope of like the mother beast. And so I kept them up and it was very hard for me in the beginning to just know that people could potentially see them, but I was like, it's okay. I'm practicing vulnerability. It's fine. And then I ended up using textiles. My mom gave me a ton of textiles that she's collected over the years from India and Canada, just really beautiful silks and colors and patterns and borders. And then, because I knew I wanted to bring my mom into the show. And so I thought, well, I'll bring her into the show by using her textiles. And then I knew I wanted to challenge myself. I had this time to really experiment. So that's why I went with textiles as well. My initial kind of idea was to teach myself how to sew with a sewing machine. But then I felt like that felt very overwhelming. So then I ended up just hand stitching. And there was something actually so laborious about it that really paralleled with motherhood. You know, the labor of like hand stitching a garment. And then even using this new to me medium, it really mimicked motherhood because I didn't know how to use it. I felt really frustrated. I'd get really angry. And then slowly I started figuring it out. So there was this parallel between my material choice and my concept. And then I ended up having another consult with Penny Lane and she gave me a bunch of really great ideas. And then I spent 5 days like stress eating, trying to figure out like what direction to go in. And then I decided that I wanted to move in the direction of creating these really larger than life beast moms and contrast them with my child who I depicted as a monkey because he's always felt like a monkey to me. And so, I drew them all out onto the wall of the studio and then I'm not much of a planner, but I figured for textiles, I should probably plan because I used my materials. So then I got some cardstock and I cut the figures out in black cardstock and then just reshaped and recut them to get them to the right point, the right size, the right proportion. And then I cut the monkeys out in craft paper and kind of, you know, stuck them on the beast or around the beast to kind of get a sense of scale. And then, yeah, I just started gathering materials and sewing. And it was really a trial and error. There was a lot of trial and error, a lot of creative problem solving. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I also didn't really research or try to figure it out. I was just like, eh, whatever, I can do this.
Oh, they're so good though.
Thanks. Yeah. And I really wanted them to reflect my drawings. So I wanted the Beast Moms to be these really sort of flat figures, all black, really large, really imposing, and then contrast them with these little monkeys that are really bright and mm-hmm. colorful, joyful. You know, I know eventually my son will come to understand this show. And so I wanted to make sure that I was representing him in this light of beauty. Mm-hmm. And I also stuffed the monkeys so that they were reminiscent of children's plushies. Mm. And then, so those took me most of the residency because I kept recutting, reshaping, redoing until they were absolutely perfect. And then I had this large textile piece I wanted to do, and I actually ran out of time. And I felt really uncomfortable putting the piece up because to me it wasn't done. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll just come in every Monday during the show and I'll just keep adding to the piece.
Oh, and then that. Someone was
like, I know, it's just like those perfectionistic tendencies, right?
Yeah.
And my friend's friend was like, Sandy, this piece really represents motherhood. It's imperfect.
I was going to say, it's like a performance piece that relates to motherhood.
Yeah, totally. And so I was like, yeah, you're right. And I just kind of let go of that. And then I had this third wall that was empty, and I had an idea of like painting something on it, just, you know, bringing my mural practice into the show. But then I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And then on the day of the opening, there was no opening, but friends still came to see the show, and I would show them the studio, and they're like, Sandeep, you need to bring this out into the show. People need to see your process behind this show. Mm. I was like, ah, that's a great idea. And so I set it up just like how I had it in my studio, my inspiration board anchored by two images of these beast drawings I'd done a couple years ago. They were flanked by two dresses that my mom had designed and gotten made in the late 70s, early 80s. And then in the center on the floor is my mom's suitcase that we bought when she had come to Canada. And then it's filled with her fabrics, and all of the sort of remnants from the studio are spilled out against the floor, like along the floor. And then I have the Post-its. So the thing that I was trying to hide because I felt so ashamed are right there front and center on the wall, along with some of the sketches, the process sketches from the show.
Mm, so good. I love like just the richness of this suitcase just kind of being spilled out, and how it's, you know, just connecting these elements of like heritage and lineage mm-hmm. and, you know, your history, but then this like isolating, lonely experience of motherhood is on the other side. And I don't know, like this, you know, unfinished textile sort of like standing there trying to engage with, you know, these two disparate things. And oh, it's so good. What a great show. And I just love that you, you know, just kind of formulated a plan, and, you know, not that you didn't change the plan and, you know, had to make compromises, but you just, I don't know, you put your heart out there and you just did it, you know?
Yeah, it feels really good. The response has been really amazing. And the messages I'm getting from people of, you know, how looking at those Post-its has really like connected with them, especially moms who mm-hmm. feel these feelings and are, you know, thank you so much for putting this out there, because I feel so alone. I feel like I'm the only one who feels these things. And that's kind of the whole point, because, you know, we're living these very siloed lives where we're feeling bad, thinking we're the only ones on earth who feel this way, when in reality, everyone is. Mm-hmm. But people are too scared to talk about it because of those ideas around judgment and vulnerability. Another reason I wanted to go big with the beasts was because, as the viewer, you're forced to look at the pieces. And in a way, like I'm forcing you to feel my feelings, mm. you know, because people are so quick to dismiss or minimize those feelings. And mm-hmm. so now you're being forced to look at those feelings. You can't run away from them. You have to confront them.
Yeah. Especially with this, like distilling, you know, distilling your experience of motherhood down to these three major feelings. And it's like, you know, just wanting people to really grasp that, I feel like is so strong. Before we wrap up, I actually want to pick one of the feelings and talk about it a little bit more. I'm going to pick the one that I engage with that resonates the most with me, which is mom rage. I don't know if you have ever done any Enneagram work, but I'm an Enneagram type 1, and the Enneagram, they talk about like your kind of the core emotions that you feel as, you know, your type. And my type, like anger, is kind of, you know, just this really big emotion for me. Yeah. That is the thing that I have felt the most shame around in motherhood, is just like losing my temper in ways that I always think, like, if I had a video of this moment, I would hate myself forever, you know?
Like, yeah, 100%.
Like, just losing my cool and like yelling at my kid, you know? And I know this relates to the emotional, like, what did you call it? The emotional intelligence, the third one. Like, just managing your emotions and not letting things like get to you and like all of that, you know, processing them in the right way, using techniques to help you through. But man, there is something. I'm going to read actually a caption from one of your Instagram posts, because this just resonated with me so much. Yeah. You said, over the years, I've become pretty good friends with my anger, but my feelings of rage really took me by surprise when I became a mother. The littlest things would, and still do, send me into fits of blind, white-hot rage. It's so weird and unsettling. Logically, I understand how lack of sleep, lack of time, and complete responsibility for a tiny human, no pressure, feed into it. In my case, 3 tiny humans. But it's the loss of control, feelings of incompetence, and activation of old wounds that fuel it. Ugh. I feel that so much.
Totally. I was like, oh, I forgot I wrote that.
Oh, it's so good. Like, oh, man. So good. And and just tell me a little bit about like some of that, I don't know, processing. Like, did you do any research around these topics, or did you just straight pull them out of your gut and your own experience?
Yeah, I think initially I had intended to do a ton of research around, you know, motherhood and rage and all of that. And then I didn't. And I just decided to come completely from my own experience and feeling. And, you know, having had that time and space to really just sit with myself and sit with my feelings, I thought about a lot of things. And I, you know, my son is like 200% my personality. So when I'm getting mad at him, I'm like really getting mad at myself. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, like, I was a very joyous child, but I was also quick to anger, and I had big feelings, you know. And, you know, my parents were immigrants. They didn't have very much money. They didn't speak a lot of English at the time. Everything was new for them. There was a very small South Asian community at that time. And so I can't imagine the stresses that they were feeling in this new, unfamiliar country with these small little kids and not understanding what resources they had access to. And so, and Indian parents too are just kind of tough anyways. And so I just remember, like, when I'd have my big feelings, they're just kind of like, they either wouldn't take it seriously or they'd just be like, ah, suck it up. So there was no like, oh, let's talk about your feelings. How are you feeling? And blah, blah, blah. And so I didn't grow up with that. Mm-hmm. And then you see how that plays out when you become a parent, because you kind of resort back to how you were raised. Mm-hmm. And I found, you know, when like everything aligned, I had perfect rest, no stress. I was like the best mom on earth.
Yep.
But, you know, that's not reality, right? How often does that happen? We're exhausted. We're dealing with the stress of everyday life. We're villageless, right? We no longer have these extended family units, mm-hmm. you know, that we can have around to help raise our children. I know in some cultures and countries that does still exist, which is amazing. But North America feels so individualistic, and, you know, not having that extra support around, you know, when it's all just you, mm-hmm. it can be so incredibly overwhelming and so isolating. And so I realized that, you know, I'd fly off the handle because I was stressed about other things, and I would just take it out on my son, mm-hmm. you know, when he would do like one tiny annoying thing. Mm-hmm. And it was like making a mountain out of a molehill, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm like, how I'm responding to this tiny little thing with the amount of rage that I'm responding with is insane.
Mm-hmm. I am right there with you. You are not alone.
How is this tiny little thing turning me into this insane rage monster? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've been really focusing on compassion and patience. The show actually was so cathartic for me, and I felt like, I just felt like this renewed energy around parenting and motherhood mm-hmm. after exploring like all of those dark feelings. And so now I'm really focused on like listening to my son and letting him feel his big feelings and just holding him if that's what he needs, talking it through if that's what he needs. And his mood has been incredible. Like mm-hmm. he's been in such a good mood. He wants to be around me all the time. He's saying all these nice things to me. And I'm like, I feel like I'm on top of the world, you know?
Yeah, I love that. And I've been reading this book. It's actually about like our relationship with alcohol, but there's so much good stuff in this book that's like not even related to that. But it's called Quit Like a Woman by Holly Whitaker.
Okay.
And she talks about, and I know she's not the first person to like use this term, but she talks about the necessary, you know, just this need that women have to mother ourselves, like how we are so fixated on mothering everyone else, yeah. you know, of creating space for other people, of being small, of fitting in, of making sure others have what they need emotionally. But if we can take that same energy and mother ourselves, like maybe we won't be as filled with rage at the random, you know, shit that our kids do. Maybe we, like, just turning some of that compassion and kindness and, you know, space and nurturing back on ourselves so that we, yeah. you know, in turn, like, can love ourselves more fully, but then, like, be more present with people and show up more authentically as ourselves. Like, it's just, it's yeah. so hard to do all of these things and be a perfect parent and process your emotions adequately in front of your kids while you're not nurturing yourself, you know?
Yes. Yes. And I think like this idea of the perfect parent, like that doesn't exist,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
these days there's so much more pressure because of social media, you know, when I look at these perfectly tiny, or I look at these perfectly curated Instagram squares and I'm like, oh, they all look so great. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, their health is so clean. Oh, they do all this stuff. And it's like, you know, it's fake. Mm-hmm. Like, we all know it's fake, but we still buy into it. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we have even, there's so much pressure for maternal perfection.
Mm-hmm. And artist then, perfection, like these days, you know, it's like a double whammy. Like we have to get it all right and post about it. And yeah.
Yeah. And then when you show any signs of maternal distress or weakness, mm-hmm. people aren't there to support you. Mm-hmm. And I like that, like what you said about showing ourselves some compassion and kindness. Because, you know, even when we rage out on our children, they forget about it. Mm-hmm. But we hang on to it. Mm-hmm. And we mull it over and we make ourselves sick just thinking about it, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like our kids love us and they know that to them we are the best parents in the world, mm-hmm. you know, but we're just so hard on ourselves because we want to be the best.
I know.
I mean, sometimes good enough is good enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's, I don't know where this, you know, saying came from, you know, but just, it's like in order to give to other people, like you really have to, You have to give to yourself. Like you have, like in order for you, for your cup to overflow so that other people can partake of your, you know, what you have to offer the world, like you have to be filling your cup, you know? And I hope mothers never stop talking about this, because I don't think it's ever going to go away. You know, it's just inherent to this like experience of parenting that you would, and we all have to figure it out for ourselves, but yeah, it's just kind of this story that's always there, and we're all, you know, trying to figure it out. And but I do think just talking about it maybe can bring, you know, us to like in our society, hopefully we can come to a larger understanding and people don't feel this need for like perfection. And I don't know, hopefully we can continue to like raise consciousness, you know, around sort of these things so people feel less pressure.
Yeah, and it starts with these conversations. Mm-hmm. And something else I've been thinking about a lot lately too is being selfish as a mother. And mm-hmm. so some days when I'm just really tired or I just want to draw, I'll just tell my son, you know what, I think I'm just going to draw for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'll set you up some drawing materials beside me if you want to draw, or you can go play with your toys. And so sometimes he'll join me drawing or he'll go play with his toys. And at first I felt a little bit guilty, like, oh, you know, I should be like playing with him. But I'm like, you know what? I'm tapped out and mm-hmm. it's getting drawing is like my meditative space. And so it just makes me feel so much better, resets me. And I think just bringing a little more selfishness mm-hmm. into my, you know, where it's like you can tell your child what you need as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, for me, it's not about me, like I don't, I also, you know, thinking about that video, like looking back on myself, I also don't want to be this like, you know, self-sacrificing, constantly like doormat. Like what I care about the most is connection with my kid, mm-hmm. you know? And I feel like we're going to have a better connection if I'm honest about what I need. Right.
Totally. And if they see you as a human with all of these complex feelings and emotions, you know, I think it's important for kids to see, you know, that their mom will cry one day because she's feeling sad, mm-hmm. or maybe she gets mad about something, but it just humanizes you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just think it's so dangerous to try to be so perfect mm-hmm. that your children don't see you making any mistakes.
Yeah. You know, it makes them feel like they have to be perfect. It just perpetuates this pressure.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, so good.
So good. Like, it's just, we need to talk about this stuff.
I know, it's so needed. And I'm so glad you're making work about it, which is the catalyst for us talking about it. It's so, so powerful. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, final five questions to wrap up our interview. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, who's your biggest art crush?
Biggest art crush. That is a really hard question to answer. I love so many artists, but if I had to choose one, it always comes back to my dear friend, Sara Khan. She does the most exquisite watercolors, but the subject matter is like super weird or even grotesque. Mm-hmm. And I love her work.
I love her mm-hmm. work too. Mind for King on Instagram.
Yeah, Mind for King. Yeah.
Yep. I love her work. Okay. What is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
I think a dream trip, I'd like to go to India. I would like to learn how to block print. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it would be such a dream to like learn folk art from a folk art master.
Oh, yeah, that sounds very dreamy. Right. I think you need to make that happen.
Yeah, I think so too. Daddy to fund it.
Yes. Okay, Sandeep, what film or book has inspired you greatly?
I would go back to Shauna Singh Baldwin's book, The Selector of Souls, because it's so multi-layered, and she talks about, you know, all of those things women have to deal with, you know, like mm-hmm. domestic abuse and rape and femicide, you know, suffering, lack of agency. And what I love about her writing and writing by Indian authors is that they talk about the most grim shit, but like in the most beautiful of ways. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of feel like, you know, she writes about these terrible subjects with this beautiful writing. And I create art around these terrible subjects with this, you know, beautiful aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And so we're both kind of doing the same thing. And actually, it was really cool. Last year, I got to be on a panel with her, which was really exciting for me. And just listening to her speak was, it's like butter. Oh. She's such an amazing speaker.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And two other Indian authors that I really, really love are Jhumpa Lahiri and Anoshi Rani.
Okay. Awesome. I'll make sure we have those listed.
Jhumpa Lahiri. She has two really amazing books of short stories.
Yes. Interpreter of Maladies.
Yeah. And Unaccustomed Earth.
Yes. So good. And I love Lowland. And I think she has a new book coming out this spring that's supposed to be really good.
Oh, incredible. Amazing.
I love all of her stuff so much. But the namesake, like as soon as you were talking about the author of The Selector of Souls, I was like, oh, that reminds me of, you know, that author who I just love so much. So
yeah. And the thing too that I like about Indian writers is that they do have a lot of female protagonists and they really do focus in on their suffering. Yeah. But stories are always about their strength and their resilience and their, you know, ability to just endure and resist.
Yes. I love it. Okay, what is your favorite meal?
Ooh, hands down, my mom's aloo parontas, they, and a hot cup of chai. Mm. And an aloo paronta is like, it's made out of like flour and it's like a square. And then you put potatoes in the middle and then you put another square paronta on top. So it's kind of like a sandwich, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of pat it down together so it doesn't come apart. And then you cook it on the stove. You put tons of butter on it. And then I dip it in my day and then I drink my hot chai.
Mm, that sounds amazing. Good. I love Indian food so much. Okay, Sandeep. And always to close, I like to give you an opportunity to give a shout out to someone who supports you in your work that you want to thank.
Yeah, I have to thank my husband, Chris. He is my number one fan. If he didn't believe that I could do this, he wouldn't have supported me, you know, in the beginning. Like it was his idea for me to stay home. Mm-hmm. And so he's just been really instrumental in my career. He's done whatever needs to be done to help me move forward. And I just, the love and support is so unconditional. I just feel so fortunate that he's my partner. And then I'd also like to give a shout out to Penny Lane. I met her in 2016, my first consult. I had like really nothing to show her. I felt actually kind of embarrassed. And then she just looked at me and said, Sandeep, what are you passionate about? And I was like, well, you know, I care about women and women's rights and gender justice. And then I just started crying. Mm. And she's like, that's what you need to do. And so that conversation with Penny Lane steered me back in the direction of the work that I'm doing now.
Mm.
You know, her guidance and mentorship over the years has just been invaluable.
Incredible. I love it.
Yeah.
We'll make sure we tag Penny Lane and get her properly listed on the site and everything and in connection with your interview. Sandeep, thank you so much. One last thing, where can people find you and your work? What's your Instagram and website?
Yes, my website is sandeepjohal.com and my Instagram is at sandeepjohalart.
Awesome. Thank you for such a great conversation, for putting this powerful work into the world, and just for everything you're doing for women artists. I just feel like seeing you doing your thing is so powerful, and I just am so grateful I got to talk to you today.
Oh, thanks so much, Kaylin. I really appreciate your support. I'm so floored by all of the work you're doing and this community that you've created. It's just amazing to see women coming together like this.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.